outside group analyzed years of Cincinnati Police Department records and says there are significant racial disparities in policing. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we discuss the report's findings and how the Cincinnati Police Department and city manager are responding. Plus, a man was wanted by police before he stabbed his ex-girlfriend to death. Are there gaps in the probation system? Then, Cincinnati Public Schools is facing millions in cuts to balance the budget. Some argue the district is putting tech before teachers. Joining me now to get the news review started are WVXU investigative reporter Nick Swartzell and local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Nick and Becca.
Hey, Lucy.
Hey.
Thank you both for being here. Nick, this new report alleges racial bias in stops made by Cincinnati police. What do the numbers show?
Yeah, so this is data that came from roughly 500,000 contact cards. Those are forms that police fill out when they stop somebody. There are a lot of numbers in the report. There's a lot of data. They come at it from a lot of different ways. But some of the top line findings are that last year, about 80% of pedestrians and 66% of motorists that CPD stopped were Black. And this is in a city that's like roughly 40% Black comparison. There were some other numbers in there spanning the full range of the report, which is from 2009 to 2025, suggesting that Black people are about three times as likely as white people to be stopped by the police.
And who did this report? What was the genesis of it? And where did the data come from?
So the analysis of the data is by a nonprofit named Campaign Zero. They're a kind of like police reform advocacy group. They're national. But the data was requested by the Hamilton County Public Defender's Office. And the Public Defender's Office says that they were in talks with Campaign Zero about some other issues, mentioned the data, and then Campaign Zero was like, we would like to analyze this data.
I see. So did the group that did this report, Campaign Zero, did they reach out to city officials about their analysis or findings, Becca?
They did, but not until after the report was largely complete. Actually, Nick and I did get an advance copy of the report, and we saw it before any city officials were able to see it. Our understanding is they got a copy of the report itself about a week before, so a week ago yesterday, and then had an in-person meeting with the Campaign Zero data analysts and organizers on Monday of this week. One of their concerns, which we can talk about more, is the city feels that they should have been given the chance to collaborate on this analysis. They say there's some data that was not included that could skew the results. So the Campaign Zero did not collaborate with the city on the analysis. They did make some adjustments based on the city's concerns over the last week.
And did Campaign Zero reach out to the police department at all?
The police department was part of the meeting on Monday, is my understanding. But when we say that Campaign Zero did not reach out to the city until after their report was initially finalized, that includes the police department.
Okay. So, Becca, how has the city responded to these findings that Nick, we're going to get deeper into the findings, but Nick gave us the general overview. How has the city responded?
Well, I think the main concerns are the city manager says that they have some initial concerns about the methodology. I'll make a distinction here between the kind of main finding that Nick mentioned, which is the total number of stops, how many of them were Black people and how many of them were not Black people. It's a large disparity. It's a basically indisputable disparity between, you know, the number of stops and their relation to the population. The report goes into a lot more detail about neighborhood specific statistics, officer specific statistics, even. And the more detailed you look at the data, the more questions the city has about that methodology. So things like geolocating that could change, you know, the demographics. If you think the incident happened in one place, it actually happened somewhere else. So those are the type of methodology concerns that the city has about those specifics. The city has expressed, Mayor Pierval released a statement expressing frustration that the city was not involved in the creation of the report. The feeling that the collaborative agreement is, I mean, it's in the title, collaborative. And so they have called out this organization for not being collaborative on this data. Now, I think you could also understand that the counter to that argument, which is that the city could attempt to delay the release or manipulate the results in some way. So, but that's just some of the concerns that the city has expressed.
So, Nick, you know, I think a lot of people are listening to this. They think this is a report about policing. Did you all reach out to the Cincinnati Police Department directly to say, hey, what do you think about this?
So, Becca reached out to, and we kind of both crafted the ask to the city manager's office, asking to talk to the city manager and a representative from the Cincinnati Police Department. We did get a meeting with the city manager, a representative from the police department, and from the city's law office.
Okay. And just to be clear, the city manager is the police chief's boss. So that's the kind of hierarchy with the city. So the police chief or anyone from the police department would need permission from the city manager to speak on this issue. So that's who was made available to us.
I see. Do you have any idea why the police chief wasn't made available, like interim police chief Henny?
We were not told. Okay. It could have been something as simple as being out of town.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, the police chief issued an email to his department that's been posted on Facebook. Several other media organizations are quoting this email, and it says in part, "I cannot overstate my disappointment with both the report and its allegations. At no point during the development of this report was the city of Cincinnati or the Cincinnati Police Department included in discussions regarding its methodology, analysis, or findings. Based on the information available to me, I believe the methodology employed is flawed, that the conclusions drawn are misleading, and fail to provide important context." I know you all talked to the city manager. Is there any more that she had to say about this? You talked about her concerns about the methodology, Becca. What else did she have to say?
I think the main message, and she reiterated this to us in our interview and also in her public statements after the report was made public, is that she and other city officials are standing behind the police department. She says she supports the current leadership of the police department. She supports the women and men who are officers in the police department. And at the same time, say that they take the allegations seriously, that they will look into it, and that if they identify what they consider evidence of racial bias, that will be addressed. So the way that the city manager has decided to go about that, she has directed an assistant city manager to pursue hiring an outside vendor to analyze both the report, so the way that Campaign Zero conducted its analysis, and also analyze the underlying data itself. I can't reiterate enough how complicated this data is. It's very, very complicated. It's not always clear that the collection is uniform. There are many contact cards that were not included in the Campaign Zero report because they were missing key fields, for example. So it's not as simple as just looking at the raw numbers and understanding what it says. So the city is going to work with an outside vendor. The other part that the city is launching is what they're calling a community problem-solving effort. This will be led by Iris Rowley, who is a contractor for the city. She helped negotiate the original collaborative agreement, and she now helps manage and kind of lead efforts on collaborative agreement-related work for the city. That will also be led by the Citizen Complaint Authority. That's the Independent Police Oversight Board, also created as part of the collaborative agreement.
Nick, I want to talk a little bit more about these police contact cards that Becca just referenced. That's where this data came from. Tell us what's on there, how long the Cincinnati Police Department has been using those. Those kind of relate to the collaborative agreement too, right?
Yes. They came out of the sort of settlement of the lawsuit that led to the collaborative agreement. They're part of the collaborative agreement. And CPD has been using them since about 2004, so more than 20 years. And what's on the cards is the person who was stopped's race, their age, the location they were stopped at, and some other information that is sometimes, you know, always filled out, or sometimes filled out, sometimes not filled out. There are various details that sometimes the outcome of the stop is on the card, sometimes not. So that kind of thing.
Okay. So sometimes it'll say this person was stopped and arrested, and sometimes that's just kind of blank.
Right.
Okay. How many, you mentioned that the Cincinnati Police Department's been using these contact cards for more than 20 years now. How many years of these contact cards did this group analyze?
Campaign Zero analyzed the contact cards from 2009 to 2025.
And what does the report suggest about potential disparities over time?
Yeah, the data from the contact card shows that over time, the number of stops, the raw number of stops that happen, has gone down significantly, like quite a bit. But as that's happened, the disparities in who gets stopped have been either persistent or in some cases have even risen higher than they were before.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned that not all these contact cards are completely filled out, Nick, but for the contact cards that do say what happens to people after they're stopped, what did Campaign Zero find happens to those people, to people generally after they get stopped?
So based on their analysis, it seems that people who are Black have about two times as likely to be arrested, have force used against them, whereas white people are more likely to get warnings or citations, less severe, kind of outcomes. So that was one finding. Now, there are some questions about the methodology in that part because it is more detailed, as Becca mentioned. And so that two times as likely might be skewed a little bit one way or another, depending on some things in the data.
Mm-hmm. Becca, you mentioned the report discusses specific police officers and their stops. WVXU decided not to list officers and supervisors by name, I noted in your report. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
That's right. The Campaign Zero report names 10 specific people who are officers that they allege have the highest racial disparity in their individual stops, and then 10 named supervisors whose officers underneath them have the highest disparities. So we did look at this. We looked at the methodology, and it's a serious allegation to name a specific person and allege racial bias. And one thing I should point out, the city, I think, would say the Campaign Zero report alleges racial bias. What the data shows objectively is racial disparity, but bias implies intent. And so that's the part that is not necessarily proven in the data. And yet to have these named officers does kind of put those allegations on a specific person. Primarily, the way that they calculated that racial disparity is to look at the CPD district and the racial demographics in that district. And if the specific officer stopped Black people at a rate higher than the Black population in the whole district, then they determine that that is a racial bias. Now, looking at that's a not a very specific way to identify, racial demographics. There are CPD districts where each neighborhood has specific racial demographics that don't necessarily match the whole district. There are even parts of specific neighborhoods that have racial demographics that don't match the neighborhood, let alone the whole district. So the report does acknowledge that that it's not a perfect way to reach a conclusion like that. And so when we spoke with our news director and our other newsroom leadership, we decided there was not enough evidence to name specific people in this way.
Well, I know that Local 12 talked with some city council members. Several expressed disappointment that Campaign Zero didn't partner with the city. Councilmember Anna Albee said the city needs to look at the data and understand whether it's being interpreted correctly. It sounds like that kind of lines up with what you heard from the city manager and the mayor's statement and that sort of thing. Is that right?
It seems that's exactly what the city plans to do, is do its own look at the data. A question that comes up for me in all of this is the city has had the data this whole time. It is the city's own data they've been collecting. Why haven't they been analyzing up until this point? What's the point of collecting the information if you're not monitoring it? The city manager, for her part, declined to answer questions like that. She said she was focused on looking forward and how to solve the issue if there was one. So she didn't have much to say about why that wasn't happening already.
What did this analysis find about Black people stopped in predominantly white neighborhoods, white people stopped in predominantly Black neighborhoods, whether police calls themselves play a role in this information?
Yeah, so the analysis finds that in predominantly white neighborhoods over the course of the data, Black people were about 4.5 times more likely to be stopped than white people when controlling for the share of the city's population. And we talked earlier about, like, depending on how you cut the demographic data, that might skew a little bit one way or another. They also found that the sort of like disparity in stops doesn't really correspond to like the level of crime in a particular neighborhood. Now, there's another sort of, I think, data caveat here, which is this geocoding issue, where like some locations in the city are really hard in a data set to map correctly. There's just problems with a street name might be similar to another street name or something like that. And so that could throw things off a little bit as well.
And just to answer the question about calls for service, this is a, or police calls, this is another issue that the city manager has brought up. You know, she says that this goes back to the idea of bias versus disparity, that the report kind of leans heavily on the idea that officers are making individual choices to pull over more Black people than white people. Now, the report openly acknowledges that the unanswered question here is, you know, how many of those stops were because an officer was dispatched, was told to pull over someone, or because of a call for service where someone called 911 and said, hey, I'm concerned about XYZ, and that resulted in a contact card. You know, the report acknowledges there's just not enough information available at this given time with the data they had to answer that question. And the city manager says, well, that's why there needs to be a more comprehensive analysis to answer that question.
Nick, you interviewed a man who was arrested last autumn. What did he tell you about what happened to him?
Yeah, so the person who asked we not use their real name, his name's Rick. I looked at all of his documentation in court and at his arrest documentation to kind of like fact check his story. He says he was picking up his younger brother at a Westside gas station. As they were leaving the gas station, there was a sort of like police sweep because there had been some reports of loitering. He and his brother were both arrested. He told police, like, hey, ask the owner, like, I'm not trespassing here. His brother allegedly had items that he'd purchased from the store. This person who we're calling Rick then was taken to Hamilton County Justice Center, booked, was later released but on bond, but didn't have his car keys, didn't have his phone, and wasn't able to go to work the next day and lost his job because of that, because he was kind of new at work and was on a probationary period. So he thinks that this is racially related because he's Black and everybody else that was arrested at this scene was Black. He strongly feels, he called it kind of a throwback situation. Like, this is the way policing used to work is kind of how he put it. And he feels like, you know, pretty disappointed in what happened to him.
How do these contact cards characterize what happened to him?
So this is what's interesting, and this kind of points to a limitation of this data and a question that we have, which is there was no contact card generated for this arrest, according to his attorney. And by the way the contact cards work, there should have been. So what that says to us is we don't know how many times police stop people and don't make a contact card, and therefore, like, how much of this data is missing effectively.
Yeah. So it sounds like that kind of points to the limitations of the data. If the cards aren't always being filled out or filled out completely. So what other questions does this raise, Becca and Nick, when you look at, I know you've been spending a lot of time with this information. There's a lot more work, I'm sure, to be done. The city's moving ahead with its own analysis. But what other questions does this raise for both of you?
Well, I think Becca touched on this earlier, but some of the geographic issues within the report, there's a lot of unknowns about how police deploy officers, how decisions are made about where an officer goes that could affect how they interact, who they interact with, right? So that's one big question. There's a geocoding question about like how much of this data is maybe like a little skewed because they have the wrong location for a stop or something like that. And those are some of the things that pop up to me is like, it'd be great to know these things, but I'm sure Becca has some other ones too.
I think this report points this out. When we spoke to the incoming chief public defender, she also pointed this out, that the questions are also why. The data can't answer why. The data can only answer what. So the other questions that this brings up are, is this embedded in policy? You know, what specific policies might be causing a racial disparity of this kind? And if so, how can those policies be changed to reverse this? And those are, as complicated as the data is, the why questions might be even more complicated. So I don't expect easy or quick answers on that. But I do think that this has certainly sparked has forced a conversation that, you know, the city was not openly having. So I think it'll be interesting to see what we find out over the next months and years.
Well, I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and investigative reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, a man was wanted by police before stabbing his ex-girlfriend to death. Why wasn't he arrested before the attack? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A man was wanted by police before stabbing a Skyline waitress to death. Why wasn't he arrested before the attack? Joining me now to talk about this is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferrara. Welcome back, David.
Always happy to be here, Lucy.
Well, tell us what happened to Alyssa Hill.
Yeah, so last Tuesday around noon, Rick Wright, the ex-boyfriend of Alyssa Hill, who's a Skyline waitress, was a Skyline waitress up at the Skyline Chili up in Norwood off Montgomery Road. He came in around noon, sat down at a booth, we learned, at his arraignment later last week, ordered, and then she had saw him, told one of the other waitresses, hey, can you go serve him? And at some point, while she was helping another customer, he took a knife out that he had brought with him and had stabbed her multiple times and then fled from the restaurant.
Wow. Well, what I mentioned that this man who's accused in her killing, Rick Wright, he was wanted by police before this attack. What for?
That's right. So the year prior, March of 2025, Rick Wright pleaded guilty to an assault charge that stemmed from an incident at the Salvation Army in Norwood involving him charging at an officer. He had gotten an incident inside the Salvation Army store, and then cops were called to the scene. The person didn't want to press charges, but he told officers, I want to go to jail, and then proceeded to get up and charge at one of them. And he pleaded guilty to that charge. He was placed on probation. He was placed into a sober living house and told to regularly check in with a probation officer. And at some point, he failed to continue to do that. He left the sober living house, stopped checking in, and a warrant was issued for his arrest last December.
You wrote that there are people who are blaming the judge who put Rick Wright on probation. Did that judge know he had violated his parole, or his probation, rather?
No. So Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge Samantha Silverstein was involved in Rick Wright's case, had placed him on probation. The charge that he was up for was a maximum of 6 months in jail. And he had already put a month in. She put him on probation to get additional treatment rather than giving him the full 6 months behind bars. And when he had finally been arrested, that was the first she had known that he had violated his probation.
Did Norwood police officers know that there was a warrant out for his arrest?
No, and I spoke with the spokeswoman over there who told me that prior to his lapse of probation, they had regularly contacted him and seen him in just other smaller interactions.
Huh. So you mentioned what Rick Wright had been charged with, that he would have faced a 6 month sentence if the judge had sentenced him to jail time instead of probation. So I can't do the math in my head that quickly. Would he have still been in jail if he hadn't been sentenced to probation?
No. So he would have, he already had served a month. So the most that he could have been given was an additional 5 months of jail time. And that was in March. So he would have been out by the fall. And this obviously happened this past, you know, week. So he would have already been out. And the logic coming from, you know, these treatment programs is to help people reacclimate to society and get them in. But because of the way the probation unit is structured, when he left the sober living house, nobody communicated back to say, hey, he left, you know, let's go looking for him or figure out what the situation was. And there were problems that arose in the sober living house. I was told that he had snuck a knife in there prior to his leaving. And again, most of these programs are voluntary to begin with. So it's not out of the ordinary that someone would check into a place and then leave.
Yeah. You said this judge didn't know that he had violated his probation until this arrest this past week. Do judges typically find out if a warrant's issued because somebody violates their probation?
No. Silverstein told us that, you know, any given time there are tens of thousands of warrants. The number we were given is 120,000 open warrants. And that's across all types. Felony cases, sure, I'd make a smaller amount of that. But a lot of it is just as simple as, you know, maybe you have a $100 fine for associated with a ticket and you never paid it and a warrant has been put out for you. So these sort of edge cases where someone is wanted and, you know, police aren't necessarily looking for them does happen quite often.
What else can you tell us about Rick Wright? Has he been in trouble with the police before, even before this arrest at that you referenced earlier?
Yeah, so starting in his early 20s, he had a long history of violence. Multiple women have claimed and pressed assault charges against him, some of which he was convicted of, some of which were dropped according to the court records we looked at. Some of these appear to be domestic situations. Others, he was just getting involved in a fight and there was some sort of altercation. At one point, a family member had pressed charges against him as well. He was sent to prison for a few years for an armed robbery where he broke into an apartment at gunpoint. So there, and also additional, you know, drug possession and trafficking charges as well.
Did you see any indication in court records about whether he'd been violent with Alyssa Hill in the past?
No, we didn't see anything specifically with Alyssa Hill. Like I said, there were some domestic incidents and a charge of domestic violence as well, in addition to the assault charges, but nothing specifically with Ms. Hill.
And with all those warrants that are open at any given time that you said like 120,000 or something, Did police try to track him down after the warrant was issued? Or do you know?
To my knowledge, based on my conversations with the probation unit and with the Norwood police, who would have been most likely in contact with them, Norwood police weren't notified that a warrant was placed out. And there's a police system for, again, the technical mumbo jumbo. There's a police system that has all the active warrants from all these people across the country. So if you are wanted for arrest, whenever you get pulled over and they're running your name, they can see, oh, hey, this, you have outstanding warrants. You're coming with us. So his name was entered into that system, but there wasn't an actual call made to any departments to say, hey, go actively search for this person.
Does the judge you all spoke to think this fatal stabbing would have been prevented if there were changes made to the probation system, if the system worked differently?
So Judge Silverstein said that judges should always be considering different ways to improve their systems and that, you know, better technology and communication could help to improve situations. But she believes that given this particular situation, you know, not having released them from probation would have made a difference. And the changes that could have been made to the system also would not have made a difference.
Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter David Ferrara. Thank you so much for your time today, David.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lucy.
Now we turn to another fatal stabbing where the accused had an open warrant. The woman whose husband was slain has filed a federal lawsuit. Local 12 reporter David Winter joins me to explain. Thanks for being here, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, Sarah Herringer filed a lawsuit last week in federal court against the city of Cincinnati and several police officers. Remind us what happened to her husband and tell us what she says in the lawsuit.
Well, Patrick Herringer is her husband and was her husband. And he was at his home in OTR. This was back at the beginning of June of 2025. A man allegedly entered his home and where he and his wife were and with a knife allegedly stabbed him to death. The issue here is that that man had recently cut off his ankle monitor. He was being monitored for another violent crime that he had committed prior.
And there was a warrant out for the arrest of that man who's accused of killing Patrick Herringer, right?
That's true. So this is the basis of the lawsuit that was filed both by his wife, Sarah, and by Patrick Herringer's wife, Sarah, and also his estate. They are the two plaintiffs. They say that because of the inaction of the Cincinnati Police Department, Patrick Herringer is now dead. There was a warrant out for the suspect's arrest, and then there was also this ankle monitor situation. The authorities are notified as soon as someone cuts off his or her ankle monitor, but unfortunately, even though this man had been stopped on two occasions, at least, according to the lawsuit, prior to Patrick Herringer's death, the police did not, for one reason or another, take him in.
So what are Sarah Herringer and the estate of her late husband, Patrick Herringer, what are they seeking in the lawsuit?
So they don't give a specific amount of money. The attorney, Todd McMurtry, had said that he believes that this lawsuit is a $100 million lawsuit. In the same breath, he also says that this is not about money, and it is about changing a culture and the Cincinnati Police Department, again, of alleged inaction, as opposed to taking action. One of the things that's mentioned in the lawsuit is that in order to keep crime statistics low, there is a culture of not making arrests. That was not backed up by any other than, in this case, any evidence, but that is the allegation that the lawsuit makes.
Has the Cincinnati Police Department or the city manager responded to the lawsuit?
No, as usual, the city manager would say that she cannot make any comments on pending litigation. So that's not surprising, as well as the police department.
Yeah. What are some of the questions you still have about this case?
You know, there are several. I mean, the first and foremost is, why, with two interactions with the suspect, Mordecai Black, why was he not arrested? Obviously not taking sides in any lawsuit like this. Allegation is that they're not following protocol. And it appears that protocol was not followed when there was interaction with Mordecai Black prior to Patrick Herringer's death, and he was not arrested. So why wasn't he arrested during this period of time? Also, there were, if you look at the number of sworn officers in Cincinnati, it has been hovering at about 1,000 for several years now. I think the full complement is something like 1,050, if I'm not mistaken. We have been down police officers for the last several years. There has been a concentrated effort to increase the number of police officers. They've added classes to get more cops on the street. But just in our research, we found that there are literally five fewer officers today than there were a year ago when Patrick Herringer was killed. So why haven't we been able to maintain the number? Why have we even lost police officers in the amount of time since Patrick Herringer's death? One could argue that there is certainly a difficulty nationwide in keeping officers, but you would think that there would be an extra effort made to get more officers to stay in the business and even add more.
Before talking to you, we spoke with an Enquirer reporter about a man with an open warrant who's accused of stabbing his ex-girlfriend to death. We're talking with you about a case where a man with an open warrant is accused of a fatal stabbing, too. Do you see similarities between these cases in terms of people who seem to have slipped through the cracks?
Yeah, certainly it's hard to ignore. And if I were to go back through stories that I've done over the past couple of years, I think I could probably come up with about a dozen more cases fairly easily. The issue is not just the fact that police aren't necessarily going after these criminals, because if you ask any cop, you know, hey, they'd be just as happy to arrest people who should not be on the street. But there's also an issue of legislation that is needed in order to give the police, to give judges an opportunity to keep dangerous people behind bars. I know that you have done several pieces on allegations that judges are too lenient in Hamilton County. That certainly is an allegation by the Fraternal Order of Police in Cincinnati. But the judges will tell you, hey, we are acting within the bounds of what we are given by the legislature. If you want people to not be let out of jail while they are awaiting their trial, if you want people to get stiffer sentences who have been found guilty, then you need to go to the legislature and have them provide that to us. That's what the judges will tell you.
Well, I've been talking with Local 12 reporter David Winter. Thank you so much for your time today, David.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, why some argue Cincinnati Public Schools is putting tech over teachers in budget talks. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. In Cincinnati Public Schools budget talks, some argue the district is prioritizing tech over teachers. And with millions to cut in spending, why is CPS required to bus kids who don't attend the district's schools? Joining me now to discuss all this are WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Hey, Lucy.
And we will be joined momentarily by Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter Grace Tucker. So I'm going to start with you, Zach. Transportation is such a big ticket item for CPS, but the district doesn't only transport CPS students. This surprised me when I first found out about it. Explain why.
Yeah, it certainly surprises a lot of people when they hear about it for the first time, because they assume like the public school is going to bus the public school kids to their public school. But here in Ohio, they actually transport private and charter school students too. It's been the state law since 1965 with the Fair Bus Bill, which is essentially requiring the same transportation offerings for private and charter school kids as public school kids, as long as they live in that school district. So that financial responsibility is, you know, really placed entirely on the public schools there. So, you know, when you look at what a public school's budget is, most of it is, you know, personnel, teachers and staff, and we will get to those costs later on, but certainly the second biggest thing is transportation. So when you look at a school district like Cincinnati Public Schools, they spend about $50 million a year on transportation, and a pretty good chunk of that is for private and charter school students. So if you look at all the students the school district pays to transport, about 20% of them don't even attend a public school.
Wow. So, does the school district get extra money from the state or from somebody to transport those kids who don't go to public schools?
Yeah, they get transportation based or transportation funding based on the amount of students they transport. But of course, that varies based on where that student is going and kind of what is available to them. So you actually look at the amount of students CPS transports. Most of the students, about 10,000 of them, are taking a metro bus to school. So high school students and now middle school students more recently are taking the city bus, not a yellow bus. And the reason for that is the cost. I spoke to Eve Bolton, longtime school board member at CPS. She talked about how it costs $350 a year to pay.
$350 a year to pay per student
to send a student on a metro bus.
Wow, okay.
But when you look at a yellow bus, that's about $3,000 a year. So there's a huge cost difference between that. So the majority of Cincinnati Public School students are taking that metro bus as a cost saving instead of a yellow bus.
So for these students who don't go to CPS schools, that CPS is required to transport, are there ever any students who are just too difficult to transport? Maybe their schools are far away or just not along any route, or how does that work?
Yeah, so it's a pretty even split at CPS. So about half of those private and charter school students are physically on a yellow bus or actually taking a metro bus paid for by CPS. But, you know, there is about 1,000 students this year that are considered impractical to transport. So instead of actually getting on a bus, what they get is what's called payment in lieu of transportation, which is, this is what we would spend to transport you, but we're not going to do that for whatever reason. They might live in a more remote area, or the school that they're choosing to attend is more than 30 minutes away, or there's a number of different factors. You know, one of the factors is it just costs too much to transport this student, so we're not going to physically do it. So a lot of times they will say, we're going to pay you instead. So that can be anywhere between $600 a year sent to that student's family, or it can go all the way up to like $1,200. So a pretty sizable amount.
Now, Zach, there are people who argue public school districts aren't doing enough in this regard, though, right?
Yeah. So this has kind of been a part of the discussion here, the payment in lieu of transportation. Yes, it's paying those families instead of transportation, but at the end of the day, that student is not getting transportation. So when you look at some of the biggest school districts in Ohio, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, you know, you're looking at 1,000 or more students each year that these school districts are paying instead of transporting. And certainly some people, private and charter school advocates, want to see school districts actually take up this responsibility, spend that money, and actually transport these students to improve things like attendance, because attendance is, you know, it doesn't matter where the school is, it's an issue and it's always associated with transportation.
Yeah. So tell us about the Student Transportation Work Group and what that group's up to.
Yeah. So this was... work group was created after the last budget. So it was created with those funds. And basically, they wanted to come up with solutions to kind of benefit these public schools, but also find a way to improve transportation options for students not in the district. So they actually came out recently with a draft report of some of these solutions that they're coming up with and kind of analyzing the amount of students this affects. So when you look at the state of Ohio, 22,000 students in the state who go to a private or charter school did not receive transportation and received a payment instead. So 22,000 students, that's a lot. So they're looking for solutions here. And of course, one of the things is provide more money for transportation, and also kind of centralizing those operations at a management level. So kind of have the County Educational Service Center kind of manage the transportation so it's not entirely on the school districts, just so there's, you know, fewer mistakes made and kind of things can run a little bit smoother. And then also eventually kind of phasing out those payments in lieu of transportation by kind of fixing the system, but kind of in the meantime, actually upping the amount that a public school district would pay a student's family.
Really interesting, a really interesting financial challenge that school districts have that you've educated us about. So thank you. Grace Tucker from The Enquirer is here now. Thanks for being here, Grace.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I know Cincinnati Public Schools Board of Education still hasn't finalized a budget for the next fiscal year. The clock's ticking on that. Remind us of the deficit the district's facing, Grace.
Yeah, so the district built their budget this year kind of from the ground up. So once they calculated all the things that they were looking in their budget, they found that they were over $58 million kind of in a deficit, or rather a gap that they need to account for. So at the latest school board meeting that I attended this week, the district presented a new slate of recommendations for cuts, which didn't look too dissimilar to what we've seen in recent weeks. There's still a handful of staffing cuts to school counselors, social workers, nurses, assistant athletic directors. But they also introduced five furlough days for all teachers, which was very polarizing.
Yeah, we'll get more into the furlough days. But tell us a little bit more, Grace, about some of the cuts that CPS is considering. Can you give us a little more detail there?
Yeah. So really to staffing, we're seeing the most cuts to really those kind of holistic social services, like I mentioned, like social workers and nurses. At a previous meeting, they presented an option to move a handful of high schools to 6 bell days instead of 7 bell days. That has since been scrapped. They also are seeing a significant decrease in spending in the central office. So your administrators, folks handling payroll, the treasurer's office are seeing lots of cuts. So really, you're seeing it from the top down, you know, more so than just the folks who are interacting with kids every day. They're really looking at reducing staffing in their central office as well and asking the remaining staffers to do more with less.
In terms of the staff that's out in the district, not the central office folks, but it sounds like there are significant cuts to people who provide social service supports to students. Grace, mm-hmm. How much need is there for those kinds of services in the district?
Yeah, well, when you're talking about a district like Cincinnati Public Schools, where there's a high rate of economically disadvantaged students, you have a rapidly increasing number of students experiencing homelessness, those holistic services are make or break, right? I mean, Zach was just talking about chronic absenteeism. That has so much to do with, you know, the sort of home life that some of these kids are experiencing. And getting a kid to school can often involve, you know, a social worker visiting the home or someone, you know, sorting out new transportation for a student. So in a district like CPS, they will really feel the loss of some of these holistic services.
Zach, Grace just mentioned these five furlough days for teachers. If the board does approve that, does that mean like five unpaid days? What would that mean?
Yeah, so that's exactly what it would mean. So you're just essentially furloughing these teachers for what is a school week, 5 days. And that will save the school district $7.5 million. So it's a pretty big cost saving out of that $58 million. So you can understand why the administration is kind of asking the teachers to accept this and do this. But on Monday's meeting, Cincinnati Federation of Teachers, some of their leaders and representatives were there and spoke about this and were really strongly opposed to it, because when you look at that $7.5 million, it's very similar to the number that they will get for a cost of living raise. So that cost of living raise for those teachers, $8 million. So 7.5 versus $8 million. They pretty much said that is kind of eliminating that raise that they're getting. You're giving us a raise, but then you're furloughing teachers at the same time, essentially canceling that out. So I believe that the term used was a slap in the face by the teachers to the administration about this. So they strongly opposed that proposal, and you can understand why.
Yeah. Grace, you also mentioned that there were concerns raised about whether the school board was putting tech ahead of teachers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's been that's kind of been a common theme even before the budget discussions. We've heard a lot of pushback from the teachers union about a handful of contracts that the district has with these popular tech tools, specifically iReady, which is owned by Curriculum Associates. It's a massive company, private equity backed. They're experiencing a lot of criticism right now with concerns around student data. So really, you're seeing this push for less screen time in class. Classrooms, I think as parents are seeing more and more news about the impacts of screens for their kids, you're seeing parents and teachers really speak out against tech in the classroom, specifically iReady and other digital curriculum. They also mentioned Amplify. Amplify Science is the basis of a lot of science curriculum in the district. And they're spending upwards of $900,000, you know, approaching $1 million for some of these curriculum. And in a time like this, you know, with the next school year months away, it's a big question to remove an entire curriculum from the budget. That would be one board member, Carrie Armbruster, spoke against that, saying, you know, when we're looking at the budget, it's not as simple as removing all of iReady as it is the basis of the math curriculum in Cincinnati Public Schools.
Yeah. Zach, just very quickly, I know some people have been calling on CPS to put a levy on the ballot. Any more talk about that?
Yeah, they're continuing to talk about it. Certainly some board members have expressed some skepticism about that, just because they want to show that the district is improving and doing more to help students. They want to come up with a sales pitch, but at the end of the day, the school district needs that money. And even if some board members are opposed, something's got to be put on the ballot to keep the school district afloat. Yeah. It's probably going to happen.
I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter Grace Tucker and WBXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.